I mean, Ray Parker Jr. is all right, but what if we put Fall Out Boy and Missy Elliott together and really ghostified the Ghostbusters soundtrack? What would Harold Ramis say about this if he came back as an actual ghost?
Why aren't we doing this live?
I was recording that, so we'll use it.
You can splice it in there.
It is the weekend, and that means new movies are out, which means only one thing. Welcome to John Serba Hates Your Favorite Movie.
I'm very excited about this. Or should I not be excited about it?
I would love it if you would be excited about it. At least you'd be excited about something. So. And now, John Serba Hates Your Favorite Movie.
Hello there, I am John Serba. And this is the I Hate Your Favorite Movie podcast. I'm here with Eric Holkren, as usual. We sat next to each other watching Ghostbusters 2016. Last night.
God, I wish that was the title. Why can't that be the title?
Well, I mean, how else are we going to differentiate it between Ghostbusters 1984?
I feel as if we just go to the John Serba School of Naming Things, and there's a colon and a number and a title, and that's how we tell the difference.
That's not my school. That's me co-opting the standard, the Hollywood standard.
Or reflecting back the culture as it stands right now.
For sure, for sure. And isn't that my job?
It really is.
It really
yes.
is. It
to
really
be is. The mirrored zeitgeist of America in 2016.
So, yeah, we'll get into Ghostbusters here a little later for one of the segments of this podcast.
that you may or may not know about... Might be the title, not sure.
We'll get to the Infiltrator here momentarily, too.
Awesome.
Bryan Cranston. And real quickly, you know, I had a week off, and therefore it's been 2 weeks since the last episode, and, you know, like, my mom and 4¾ other people were like, where was the I Hate Your Favorite Movie podcast last week? Well, I was on vacation, and I warned you last time. But, you know, and I want to just take a few minutes to play catch-up. Why are you laughing?
Because you're like, if you had listened to the one before, you would have known where I went. So clearly I know you did not listen to episode 10.
I didn't go anywhere. I stayed home.
It was a Serba staycation.
A staycation, yeah. So I just want to catch up on a couple of things. One of them being The Legend of Tarzan, which I teased talking about a couple times. And ended up seeing and enjoying. I enjoy
really?
The Legend of Tarzan.
Nice.
And you know, it's in spite of, like, logic and reason at times. Because, you know, what are multiple strikes against it? One, who cares about Tarzan? It's 2016. Two, CGI everything. So, you know, like, you look at the poster, The Legend of Tarzan poster, and there is Alexander Skarsgård with no shirt on, standing there among a bunch of obviously CGI gorillas. And three, Alexander Skarsgård.
Yes, obviously CGI.
Not wearing a shirt.
Yes.
You know, I mean, there's just a lot of roadblocks, a lot of hurdles. And you know what? I think part of the reason I like this is purely contextual. Purely contextual, partly because it felt like an old-fashioned adventure. I mean, I know it's got all the high-tech special effects and all that, but it felt like an old-fashioned adventure. I didn't feel like I needed to watch six movies prior to it and wait for three more in order to get the whole story. It was a nice, self-contained story. It didn't beat us over the head with Tarzan's origin, even though, you know, it cuts to that. You know, it's set up in some flashback sequences. And it's reasonably well done. David Yates, who directed a bunch of Harry Potter films, directs it, you know, he knows what he's doing with a camera and an angle and some good lighting and things like that. Alexander Skarsgård is like, he's kind of, you know, he poses. That's his acting. He's not asked to really do anything more than pose, you know, with his shirt off and like... Wow, Tarzan, you know, he must have done CrossFit out there in the jungle because he's just ripped. And the film actually opens with Tarzan back in London, you know, part of that whole aristocratic thing. And immediately you go, oh, this is already doing what I don't expect it to do. The ending kind of, it's kind of a mess. It's like literally a mess of wildebeest at times. A number of things that were good about it. The cast is actually nice. Margot Robbie plays Jane, Tarzan's wife, and she has some charisma, and she doesn't need to take her clothes off in order to have that charisma, which I thought was kind of refreshing. Sam Jackson plays George Washington Williams, a Civil War vet who goes along with Tarzan as he journeys back to the African jungle to deal with some political unrest between the colonials, the European colonials, and the natives. And then Christoph Waltz is the bad guy. You know, he's the capitalist slave trader who's there for diamonds and riches. And we get one of those great scenes where, you know, it kind of goes without saying, does Jane get kidnapped and Tarzan have to rescue her? Of course. So there's a scene where he seats Jane across from him while they eat dinner. So you get to watch Christoph Waltz eat malevolently, which is that's one of his strengths, you know? Did you see Inglourious Basterds?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
La creme, attendez la creme. And he just eats that, and it's the scariest thing ever. So, you know, he kind of does that again. I like the movie despite many things. So Legend of Tarzan, actually not doing as poorly at the box office as I expected it to. I expected it to completely flop. And people are actually going to see it, even though it's not getting great reviews. The general public doesn't seem to really love it either. But, I don't know, I beg to differ in this case.
Well, it's interesting because you've talked on the, whatever we are, 11 or 12 episodes of this podcast that it's been the summer of things you didn't want to see. And you wonder if at this point in July that the consumer is just like, oh, okay.
I'll go see Tarzan.
Or I won't, you know, or I won't, right? Yeah. Like I'm going to go see the things that, to your point, the recommendation on The Shallows, go see The Shallows because it's just a really, really fun movie in 90 minutes. But there's The Shallows. There's certainly Finding Dory. If you're going to compare that to Pets, you're likely going to see Finding Dory instead. So I wonder if some of these things don't thrive in the way that they might normally do because either people are waiting for other things that are coming out in August or they're just totally burnt out on things that they didn't want to see in the first place.
Yeah.
I mean, like the 64th Tarzan movie.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's done $90 million.
Which is like, what, an eighth of what it cost to make?
Half of the production budget.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's the kind of movie that's going to play well overseas.
Yeah, for sure.
More so than with American audiences. So I don't see this not being a profitable movie. Do I really want to see Skarsgård come back and play Tarzan again? I don't know. Maybe if they make him do something besides stand there silently. You know, 30 seconds after he just pumped a bunch of iron and then ran in front of the camera.
Right.
So that's what those guys do, you know. They, immediately before their shirtless scenes, pump a bunch of iron so they just look. It's like putting an extra gust into that balloon.
That was the most ridiculous explanation of that I've ever heard.
Yeah. How else do you think they look that way? So yeah,
I assume that they gave up carbohydrates and eat only chicken. That's what I assume that they did.
Well, yeah. Well, that too. Because I remember interviewing. I got to interview Chris Hemsworth several years ago. Just when the first Thor movie came out, and it was just like waking up every 4 hours to eat protein. Like, wow, that's some commitment.
Yeah,
that's crazy. That's a level of commitment that. I mean, I guess if you're getting paid millions and millions of dollars to play a guy in a cape or a guy in a loincloth. Tarzan never wears a loincloth in this, actually.
What does he wear?
Well, I mean, he has, like, culottes or whatever. I don't know. I mean, he gets to the jungle fully clothed, but it's just a matter of time before, you know, he gets...
Right, before the evolution of clothing goes the wrong way.
He gets in enough scrapes that make him either hot or rip the clothing off of him. So...
That scrape sure made me hot. I should take my shirt off.
So go figure. I enjoyed The Legend of Tarzan. The other one we're going to go back is Mike and Dave Need Wedding Dates. And you know what? I mean, I didn't hate this movie. It kind of says a lot when, you know, I walk out of a screening and you know, I've got, you know, marketing people who ask me, they want to know what I thought of it. You are that person on occasion.
Occasionally, and I was going to be that one on this one, and I didn't go to that one. So,
and I walked out and I was like, "What do you think?" And I said, "Well, I didn't actively loathe it," which is sort of praise for this type of like gutter, like second tier gutter comedy, because there are some gutter comedies that I've enjoyed quite a bit, the Judd Apatow films, and you know those get pretty gross, you know, verbally and visually, but this is one where I was just like, you know, the biggest problem with this movie was thinking that Zac Efron and Adam Devine could like headline this, you know. These are some bland guys.
Well, and Zac Efron had already failed at that last year, right? Last summer at this time with the We're Your Friends, right? Wasn't he that lead on that one?
I don't remember now. The last couple things I saw him in were the Neighbors films and Dirty Grandpa,
which you loved.
Oh, I loved it so much. That's for next week when we go over the best and worst of the year, first half of 2016. I'm not going to tell you where Dirty Grandpa falls in between those two categories. But you know, these guys really don't have a whole lot of charisma. And Zac Efron, he was actually kind of funny in the Neighbors movies because he's just he's a supporting guy. You know, he comes in and he plays a poker face while everyone else is goofy and he goes against the grain. And he kind of worked in that movie. But here, you know, he and Adam Devine are these brothers. They want to, they're being forced to bring wedding dates. They're these party animals and they, in their mind, they are the lives of the party when in fact, in everybody else's minds, they are the deaths of the party because they always make everything go haywire. So their parents for their sister's wedding, they're like, you are bringing wedding dates because they'll calm you down. That is the logic of this film that is actually based very loosely on a true story about a Craigslist ad where two guys were looking for wedding dates. So there you have it. The first ever movie based on a Craigslist ad. So the dates they find are played by Aubrey Plaza and Anna Kendrick, who I think are two incredibly funny actresses. So, you know, I sat there the whole time watching this going, they are funnier than this movie. You know, whoever, the writers of this movie did not do anybody justice. Andrew J. Cohen, Brendan O'Brien, I am calling both of you out because this is a sloppy script. You know, the Plaza and Kendrick play these kind of burnout type, lazy, stoners, you know, unemployed, the whole thing. And they eventually kind of almost become sort of human beings, you know, like everybody in this. But that's not the point of this movie. The point of the movie is to make you laugh. I just didn't laugh at it very much. And it should have been called Alice and Tatiana, Our Wedding Dates. Because Anna Kendrick and Aubrey Plaza they have way more charisma than Devine and Efron. And Devine, by the way, do you know who Adam Devine is?
Yep.
I first saw him in the Pitch Perfect films as a supporting player. He was like the head of the like rival.
Sure.
Rival a cappella group. And he's like Jack Black light, you know, just, you know, yeah. So, yeah, I didn't actively loathe Mike and Dave Need Wedding Dates. Now we'll catch up with the current films now. First of all, The Infiltrator,
which you were talking about last night, and I was very excited to hear what you think about it because it looks kind of interesting, and you're not hearing a ton about it.
I think this is going to kind of come and go, and people are going to shrug at it, you know, and you'll get a handful of Breaking Bad fans who love Bryan Cranston, and if you want to see Bryan Cranston do his thing, you could do a heck of a lot worse than this. This is a pretty entertaining, kind of by the numbers, deep cover drama. Cranston plays a guy named Robert Mazur, who's a real guy,
yep.
U.S. Customs undercover operative. And what Mazur did, he was the linchpin in a program to take down this money laundering scheme that ended up, you know, destroying the seventh largest bank in the world because they were actively and wittingly and knowingly laundering money for Pablo Escobar, the
gangster,
the infamous Mexican cartel leader.
Right.
So this is a classic case of a star kind of elevating the picture, where the picture is watchable. It's a decent story. It is made better by the charisma of its star. It's directed by a guy named Brad Furman, who, like, the same criticism can be applied to The Lincoln Lawyer, which he directed, which was this kind of boilerplate, you know, courtroom drama brought to life by Matthew McConaughey, you know? So Cranston, the writing is a little flimsy at times in this because you want to get a little more into the nitty-gritty where it kind of glosses things over. You want to get a little more into Mazur's head as he's like a good guy posing as a bad guy who starts to, you know, the deeper he gets, the more corrupt the people are, the higher up the ladder he gets. And he and Diane Kruger, who is the agent posing as his fiancée, they end up like becoming really good friends with one of Escobar's top guys, played by Benjamin Bratt, like to the point where they are socializing with them regularly, you know, and to the point where Bratt's character's wife is like helping Kruger shop for wedding dresses, you know. It's like they get in that deep, you know, and so but you don't get any sense that any real depth out of these situations and characters. There are a couple, but it's a nice suspenseful movie, you know. It leads up to a really kind of cool, intense finale. You know, it's a true story. The bank fell. You know what? You kind of know what's going to happen, but you're still involved. You still want to see exactly how it happened. Or at least how the movie dramatizes it, and it leads up to their two aliases' wedding, which I thought was a pretty kind of ingenious hook to the narrative. And I have to say, like, you have a bunch of unsung people beneath Cranston. John Leguizamo plays one of his associates who's like the man on the street. He's the nitty gritty guy. He can blend right in with the thugs and enforcers, and he's really strong. Where I can't tell you how many times you see Leguizamo and you just go, you know, he's in so many subpar movies but this is like, oh well, there's some real inspiration there. Diane Kruger, who, like, she's best known for the National Treasure movies, you know. I remember her from Inglourious Basterds, and she was terrific in that. And she's very strong in this as well. And then Benjamin Bratt, another one of those guys who's like, does he do anything that... He doesn't do top-tier films ever, you know. and you see him, and it's like, oh, well, you know, he's pretty convincing. So you've got this good supporting cast beneath Cranston, and that all hooks you in. I recommend this. It's a 2-hour movie. It's pretty tense. It's enjoyable. It's entertaining. It's nothing you haven't seen before, but Bryan Cranston. You know?
Yes.
He was in Trumbo last year playing Dalton Trumbo, and it was another instance where he had a great supporting cast. The writing was way better in that. And I'm not just saying that because the guy who wrote the screenplay from that is from my hometown, Grand Rapids. but the writing was very strong in that. And, you know, he's sort of not taking these big flashy roles. I mean, he's taking these roles with a little bit of depth and substance and challenge to them. And I admire that in any kind of actor who wants to go out there and challenge himself.
Very cool.
Yeah. Bryan Cranston. He's a good one.
He's a keeper, everybody.
So, and now,
John Serba hates your favorite ectoplasm-filled movie.com.
So, if Ghostbusters, (2016), (),
not actual title,
is your favorite movie, I don't know if I hate it. I mean, I kind of hate it. We walked out of the theater last night, and you said, that is the worst thing I've seen this year. And I'm like, well, you haven't seen Dirty Grandpa, Mother's Day, Warcraft, The Huntsman. You know, I mean, there's any number of things. And you're like, oh my God, the product placement, like Mother's Day, the do-over. We're way worse when it came to product placement. But, you know, this really is kind of a mire. The whole Ghostbusters remake thing has become this weird social discussion.
Well, I was telling you, you know, last night you warned me, like, yeah, you're not allowed to hate this movie. Just so you know, you're not allowed to say anything bad about this movie. And I was like, yeah. I read all the hatred that it was a female cat, you know, before it came out. So, as you said this morning, sight unseen, all the hatred, I got it. But good luck finding somebody who's genuinely looking at this and going, look, it's not that it's terrible, but it's just not funny. And no. If it's supposed to, in my opinion, if it's supposed to be a comedy and it's not funny, then it failed. And it honestly has nothing to do with who's in the movie.
No.
The jokes just are not funny at all.
No.
At all.
In the original Ghostbusters was a remarkable screenplay. How many quotable lines are in that? You know, you're not watching the original Ghostbusters to see the great character arcs of the guys played by Bill Murray and Dan. You are there to see Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd and Harold Ramis spit out some great one-liners. That's part of the reason that whole movie exists. So, you know, I'm not going to go and say, oh, well, the characters aren't very good. The writing is not good. Ghostbusters coined a million phrases in 1984. And the new one is like, yet another, you get a car, Oprah reference, yet another instance of, that's going to leave a mark. Who writes that? And it just tells me that, like, this screenplay needed a half dozen more passes to bring it to life. Not just in the comedy of it, but in the story of it. The story is this kind of slipshod thing that's thrown together. It never really hooked me at all. You know, one of the main conceits at the beginning of the film is Kristen Wiig and Melissa McCarthy are former friends. They wrote this book about ghosts together, and then they had this acrimonious falling out, and now they're coming back together. What with one thing and another. Quote Roger Ebert. what with one thing and another, they come back together to start the Ghostbusters. And their reunion scene just flops. You know, Wig goes up to McCarthy's, lab It's just filled with doohickeys. She's got a stupid thing on her head, you know. And it goes on forever. It's like 10 minutes a movie, I swear. And it just, they're like, it's like they're digging through grandma's candy dish, trying to find the one, like, good jelly bean at the bottom. You
trying
know?
To get past all the crazy Werther's to get to the actual piece
exactly.
of candy.
Yeah, exactly. And the slowly petrifying Mary Janes and all that have been there forever. And who wrote that? It just felt like they were farting around for a long time. And there's another scene where, okay, you know, the Ghostbusters are formed, and it's Kristen Wiig and Melissa McCarthy and Kate McKinnon, and Chris Hemsworth is the guy who applies to be their secretary, and he is just this remarkable idiot, you know. But they're wowed by him because he's, you know, this chiseled hunk of man flesh with nice hair. And that scene just went on for weeks without a laugh. There's just, can we cut this down? Can we trim it? Can we make it leaner and meaner? You know, can we narrow it down to a half dozen lines instead of, like, you know, just this kind of flailing that, and that kind of thing starts to define the movie. So you have that. And that style of, like, pseudo-improvisational comedy has worked before for, like, Melissa McCarthy. Remember when she's in This Is 40? She shows up and she's just spitting these lines out.
Yeah.
And then later you see the outtakes and you know, they took the six best out of the 50 that she spit out. So you know that there's that kind of quality happening with these movies. Because you don't hire Melissa McCarthy to be in your film, or Will Ferrell for that matter, not to have some of that kind of spontaneous thing happening.
To that point, don't you think that it feels like Judd Apatow is just better at getting them to do that? You know, like when you watch those movies, it's all actors like that or actresses like that that can operate in that universe where, okay, the scene is going to be you're recording a podcast and you're going to drink a cup of coffee, and where I want you to land is blah. What happens in between, you two figure it out.
Well, and the main difference is, well, Judd Apatow writes character comedies, and this is a sci-fi, you know, give me a good laugh kind of comedy. Like, you know, it's a little more superficial in that sense. But I think the main thing is... it feels like they're making up their characters on the fly. You know, there really isn't much of a foundation there because, who are these people? You know, even in the slightest bit, at least you got the sense that, you know, Bill Murray's character in the original Ghostbusters was this kind of almost a huckster who's this sort of half-assed scientist, you know, back off, man, I'm a scientist. Like he's overcompensating with that statement. You know, there's some suggestion there in the performance and in the line readings and that. And in this, it's just like, how many times are we going to see Kristen Wiig get slime dumped on her? You know, I mean, it happens like three times in the first 20 minutes of the movie. It's like, can we get to a different joke now? And that just... that just speaks to me bad writing. It speaks bad writing. And if you really want to, you know, you and I are the same generation. Did you love the original Ghostbusters when you were a kid?
I remember really, really liking it. I mean, maybe not as far as love. I loved the character. So I think to your point about Judd Apatow, like I feel the first Ghostbusters was a character comedy that had ghosts in it. This is a sci-fi comedy that has people who showed up and want to act in it. You know, so I don't know that I would say maybe beloved, right? Like it's not, I would never have said it was my favorite movie ever, but it's certainly one that you look back on. And I was even saying this morning, you know, you remember the emotional arcs of that movie because it was what really kind of pushed it to the next comedic interchange between the characters.
Yeah.
And this never had that. It never, I mean, if you think about when you talk about character development, if you think about what happened between Bill Murray and Sigourney Weaver, there was time in that movie for that to like bubble, There was no time in this movie for anything like that to bubble. Yeah. And I said this morning, you know, there's the scene where the street cracks and it feels like all is lost and the Ghostbusters show up and everyone in the city yeah. goes crazy and they go up the stairs and they have no idea what they're going to do. You feel none of that in this movie. It's just like, well, we've got an hour and a half to fill. At the end of it, we're going to fill 7 minutes of a ghost battle. And yeah. because it's not – can't even be more than 10 minutes, the whole yeah. – finale.
Yeah.
So it just felt like it's, and I don't even know, I'm not even looking at the times. It feels like it was longer than the original one, but failed to like produce any story arc in the longer time period.
There's no suspense to it, you know, and that's, I keep going back to this, but it's like, it just, that's just bad writing. It's bad writing is what it is. And, you know, the other thing is like, well, you know, when we can't come up with a good joke, let's make sure we make a reference to the original movie. And you are actually hurting yourself by doing that. People love that original one too much. So you put Bill Murray in this movie. This is not a spoiler. We know it's coming. We know Bill Murray is gonna make a cameo in this movie and some of the other cast members. So they do these like big reveals when the character turns around and you see who it is. And it's that kind of like, you know what? You're hurting yourself because we are automatically making the comparison when we should let this movie stand on its own. I firmly believe that. More so than anything else, a movie should be judged on its own terms. Is Ghostbusters 2016 funny? You know, not is it funnier than the first one? Is it less funny than the first one? And I just did not find it plain, flat, simple, funny. There are two
really, really good, really, really good jokes, and that's about
yeah,
it.
Yeah. And it's a terrible thing that we can name two. You should be able, I can't name how many funny, I can't list how many funny lines there are in the original Ghostbusters. As a point of comparison, I can't list how many funny lines are in the 40-year-old version or Knocked Up. Tons. Dozens of them.
I would argue, and I know that this is maybe not a show that you've watched in its entirety, but I would argue, by comparison, you likely couldn't name the number of funny jokes that happen in a single episode of Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
But I can tell you the two that I saw last night in Ghostbusters.
Yeah, exactly. Because they stand out among a bunch of mediocre stuff.
And I would say if you really like, to keep it the theme of the podcast, if you really like Melissa McCarthy, I bet you have a favorite Melissa McCarthy movie by which you cannot name the number of one-liners that she mm-hmm. knocks you over with mm-hmm. in the 90 minutes or 2 hours that she's in. You will have zero problem picking out the one or two things that you like about this movie.
You know, and this isn't me. You know, Kristen Wiig is terrific in Bridesmaids. I like Melissa McCarthy. I am a huge Gilmore Girls fan. I liked Melissa McCarthy before you did. and Paul Feig directs this, and he's directed some really strong female-fronted comedies. Spy, The Heat, Bridesmaids. Really strong stuff, and I just, you know, he co-scripted Ghostbusters, and I wonder, you know, I think this may be the difference, at least, you know, purely presumptuous on my part, but I don't think it's a coincidence that his original movies are more successful than him trying to update a beloved, you know, 30-year-old classic comedy. So it's interesting to see. I can't help, you know, and part of the big backlash was a lot of people going, I don't want to see women playing Ghostbusters. It's just this kind of backward kind of thinking, and that's the kind of quagmire you try to avoid when you're criticizing a movie like this. But you know, this cast deserves something better than just, you know, standing around and...
Well, because it really feels like if you got the four of them together and let them do whatever, it would be funnier than what this ended up being. Mm-hmm. Because it really feels like Leslie Jones in particular, who's not getting a lot of press because she's not Melissa McCarthy or Kristen Wiig, you know, her timing is impeccable. You know, her, the way that she physically plays the character is really well. There's just nothing funny for her to say.
No, no. Right? Well, like, and part of it are just these, like, didn't it just strike you that some of her stuff was just the typical sassy black woman stuff, you know? And I hate to say that. I really hate to say that. But it was stereotypical in that sense, you know? And McCarthy and Wiig play, I like the idea of the characters more than I actually like the execution of them. Where there are these women who are scientists, they're, you know, they're kind of nerdy and geeky, and, you know, they button their buttons all the way to the top, and they have dorky hairdos and stuff, you know. And it's that kind of, like, I see what they're trying to do. They really are. And I have a good friend on Facebook who said, you know, I grew up kind of looking up towards Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd and Harold Ramis as these kind of male figures. My daughter deserves the same. So that it's noble. It's noble to do that. I really do. I think it's a great idea to cast these women in these roles. Because, you know, this has been the discussion as of late when it comes to, like, the Rey character in the Star Wars films, where all of a sudden, instead of Princess Leia being this sort of damselish, I mean, she always had a little more spunk than your typical damsel or whatever, but it was always Han Solo and Luke Skywalker leading the way. So then you see Rey show up in The Force Awakens, and she's this, like, guiding narrative force, you know, that's the kind of thing that young girls need to see on a movie screen way more often.
1,000%. And I know that I told you this, for as much of a mess of a movie it was, Wonder Woman is hands down the best thing in Batman versus Superman.
Sure.
Hands down.
For sure.
And I'll say this again, because I think I said it on the first podcast. Like, I walked out of that movie and I wanted to see the Wonder Woman movie on Monday.
Yeah.
I could have cared less if I ever saw those two ever, Batman and Superman, it again, but I wanted to see her on Monday.
But part of that is, I think it's refreshing to write the character as well as watch it, because we just don't see the characters enough. So this is very disappointing. I thought Frozen was a great feminist movie. I thought Mad Max Fury Road was a great feminist movie. You know, there have been a number of great feminist films like that in recent years. Even though it wasn't a really good movie, strong feminist viewpoint, Maleficent, you know, let's make this person complicated.
was the Maleficent thing. That was the subtitle, that one.
You know, Maleficent, colon. So, you know, there have been, Disney has been really remarkable at that, at doing that as of late. So this Ghostbusters is a real disappointment when it comes to that. Kate McKinnon, a lot of people are talking about Kate McKinnon, who's the, of the Ghostbusters, she's like the, you know, kind of, she's not the Bill Murray type, but, you know, she's
Harold Ramis, right? Isn't that?
Harold Ramis, like, inventor. She comes up with all the gizmos that they, you know, fire off in the alleyway in some scenes that don't really work comedically. and a lot of people, and you sense that charisma just bubbling, but never really coming to a boil. You know, she doesn't have a good character to work with beyond that kind of smirk, the attitude, the punk looking hairdo, you know, it never takes hold beyond that. And I think that's one of the big problems with this, you know, and I really wanted to love these characters more than I did. I didn't actively loathe the characters. Raiders. That's the theme. That's the theme of this week's podcast. I didn't actively load any of this stuff. So Ghostbusters, a big disappointment. I did not go into this movie with my dukes up. I really did not. I swear.
Nor did I. But I mean, what are you going to do? You sit there for 2 hours and you laughed twice. Like, of course, this is what you're going to come out with.
I know. Well, one, there weren't very many people in the theater last night, which is a little telling. Granted, there were a handful of showings last night, just at the one complex we were at. But I didn't hear a whole lot of laughter either. There are a couple of people in the back that was like, "What? They must have just walked out of the bar."
They were planted to get you all to laugh and everything.
Were they doing bong hits on the car before the movie?
They were Sony employees set to laugh at every joke.
Trying to push the snowball down the hill, but it's summer. It doesn't.
Right.
That's the metaphor. Isn't that a great metaphor? Pushing a snowball down a hill in summer.
Yes.
You push it down, it just melts.
Yes.
I am so clever. That's why you listen to the I Hate Your Favorite Movie podcast.
Everybody. And that in and of itself is essentially the synopsis for Ghostbusters, the jokes that you have to explain in order to make them funny.
These don't even need to be explained.
No, I'm with you.
These are all...
Somebody has some explaining to do. Might not be the jokes, but somebody has some explaining to do.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, if you go to this, and I'm sure some of you still will because you're compelled to want to enjoy something. You know, state of the end. There's a scene setting up a sequel after the credits,
which I'm hoping somebody else writes, which would be nice. Yeah,
exactly. I really part of me wanted to like this. I went into it wanting to like it, partly so I could say to everybody who said, to all the tons and tons of people who said, this movie is going to suck. This movie is going to suck. The trailers suck. And I wanted to come out of the movie saying, you know what? Watch it first. Because it drives me crazy when that happens too much. I understand it because I'm guilty of it too. I write lists. The most and least anticipated movies of the summer, you know, because you look at things and you go, oh my gosh, do I have to sit through Johnny Depp as the Mad Hatter again? You know, so you do walk into things with a chip on your shoulder. I understand that. But I also walked into Alice through the Looking Glass, glass half full. You have to. And I really wanted to walk out and say, you know what, watch the movie before you crap. And I don't know, this is not deserving of a whole lot of praise. I wanted it to be that cautionary tale where it's like, don't believe the marketing hype.
Sure.
Don't believe that. Don't believe those, you know, three trailers that you think were terrible. You know, don't believe that's representative of the movie. Apparently they are. don't believe that women can't play Ghostbusters. And you still shouldn't believe that, even if you think this movie is not
that's
good.
Holistically, you know, that's, not, yeah, that's absolutely yeah. Not true. Like, if
so, and I'm not trying to be PC about it, that is the truth of life.
Yeah, no, if somebody had given them a script to work with, it probably would have been very funny, but it needed to be, mm-hmm. I think it needed to be paced much different, and somebody needed to take the actual script that they had and burn it and start all over again.
Yeah, pretty much. You know, this transcends. It's unfortunate that we can't talk about these issues in greater depth because the movie does not inspire it at all. It, you know, badness transcends any kind of social discussion. So if a movie does not succeed on its own terms, there's no point in talking about it in any kind of larger context.
All right.
And then. I really wanted to. So if Ghostbusters is your favorite movie, I kind of hate it. Next week, are we going to get to the best and the worst
we are.
Of the year so far? We're going to look back at the first 6 months of the movie cinematic year, 2016. We'll look at the best and the worst. And after that, we'll catch up with Star Trek.
Oh, that's right. That's
Beyond. Yeah. There's no colon.
There's no colon.
Can you believe that?
And if,
Star Trek Beyond.
And if we go by the trailer we watched last night, there's only one joke in that one, too. So,
well, yeah, that was one where I'm like, they threw something funny in at the end. And I was like, man, that was getting pretty grim for a while. I'm glad, you know. Give Simon Pegg something funny to say, please.
Simon Pegg wrote it. He should give himself something funny to say.
Did he write
it? Yeah, totally wrote it.
Really?
Yeah.
Why did I not know that?
I don't know, but he should write himself some more jokes in that movie if there's only one.
Are you going to believe the trailer?
Well, you just told me to. Always believe the trailer. Isn't that what you just said? Always believe the trailer?
Sometimes you should, and sometimes you shouldn't. Most of the time you shouldn't. Wow, I didn't know. Simon Pegg. There it is. Written by Simon Pegg and Doug Young. Well, I'm automatically excited about this. Even more excited. I like the Star Trek films.
No, so do I. I just think it's funny that all you have to do is put Simon Pegg on it, and you're automatically excited about it.
I like Simon Pegg. There we go. There's my bias.
There's nothing not to like.
There's my bias. You know,
but everyone can have an off day.
And you know what? You know why I liked? I think Simon Pegg is a good writer already, even though I haven't seen the movie. He did not put a colon in the title. It's just Star Trek Beyond.
I think it's interesting you attribute that to him automatically, since there's two writers. Any one of them could come up with the title.
Well, yeah.
Paramount could have come up with the title. They just handed in pieces of paper.
Star Trek Beyond next week, and I'll take a look at the Kristen Stewart indie sci-fi film, Equals, which is directed by the same guy who did Like Crazy. It has some potential. We'll see. And Ice Age Collision Course, if I can squeeze that in, we'll talk about that.
You want me to go see that for you?
I could probably already, considering the first four were the exact same movie. Four times.
This one will be different.
They keep adding to the cast.
It's got space.
Here I just went off on this lecture about not prejudging too much, but I can tell you already that Ice Age : Collision Course is gonna have like some pretty funny stuff with the little scrat guy, and the rest of stuff will be boilerplate because that is exactly what I'll get. Prove me wrong, Ice Age Collision Course. Prove me wrong. Thank you, Eric.
You got it.
Thank you for listening. I'm John Servo.